Today, with shock polls ahead of the Irish general election, could this be the end for the country's Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar? And Westminster journalists push back on number 10.
I was following Leo Varadkar on Canvas down Grafton Street in Dublin City Centre, and he was getting a mixed reaction from a lot of people, but the most rapturous reaction of all was largely from young Chinese women. When they spotted him, it was all, "Leo, Leo, 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 we love you." And they mobbed him, and of course he loved it.
I'm a fire horse. Wow.
And then at the end they turned around with a two thumbs up and said, "Vote for him." And the reaction of the Irish people around, I mean, they're kind of enjoying the spectacle, but it just was notable that, you know, this was probably the most positive reaction that I saw that morning were from foreign people.
It's no wonder that Irish Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has a bit of stardust. He's made quite a name for himself on the world stage. Jogging with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
A very special connection, person to person, united in friendship.
Taking his male partner to meet US Vice President Mike Pence.
We are, after all God's children.
And helping end the stalemate over Brexit.
We may sometimes differ, but we're bonded by our shared past and our shared kinship.
But as he leads his political party into a general election this weekend that is likely to be dominated by domestic issues, things aren't looking so rosy. The latest opinion poll places Varadkar's Fine Gael party in third place, behind its usual rival Fianna Fáil in second, and with Sinn Féin surging into the lead. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, could it all be over for Leo Varadkar? Rory, let's go back to June 2017 when Leo Varadkar became Ireland's Prime Minister. How and why did that happen?
His predecessor was Enda Kenny, who was a leader of the Fine Gael party and also the Taoiseach. He had become an unpopular figure within his own party, and he had promised to step down while he was in office.
Rory Carroll is The Guardian's Ireland correspondent.
And he kept his word, and so Varadkar then was elected by the Fine Gael party to replace Enda Kenny as leader.
I deem him elected the 11th leader of Fine Gael.
And therefore he also became Prime Minister.
And I think if my election as leader of Fine Gael today has shown anything, it is that prejudice has no hold in this republic.
Even though he wasn't elected by the people, it was seen as a momentous moment for the country, because here we had, for the first time, a mixed-race prime minister. His dad was an immigrant from India. We also had the first openly gay prime minister. It was a huge kind of seismic thing, really.
Did any of those factors make his colleagues cautious about selecting him?
No, in that he came out as gay while he was a cabinet minister.
I am a gay man. It's not a secret, but not something that everyone would necessarily know, but isn't something I've spoken publicly about before.
And he received a very positive response. He was astonished by that and heartened, and I think it made Irish people feel good about themselves. So it certainly didn't do him any harm. But I think the reason he was elected by his own party was that he was seen as a very articulate, able debater in Parliament. He had a reputation for being quite blunt and forthright and telling it like it is. And this played often very well with voters, because Irish politicians can be very voluble, circuitous when they're discussing issues. And here was a guy who was quite, you know, to the point, and people found it quite refreshing. And also his youth was another factor in his favour. So the party thought, well, we have a winner here.
And politically speaking, where did he stand? What was his driving motivation?
He was a political nerd as a boy. He loved kind of statistics and policy papers, even as a teenager. And he was actually quite right wing as a student, which is why to this day the some people call him Tory boy. But once he entered government as a young minister, he became, much like the rest of his party, rather centrist, actually kind of cautious on social issues, and rather conservative on fiscal economic issues. If were he a British politician, he'd almost certainly be in the Conservative Party.
You say that, but he's overseen some pretty big liberal shifts in Irish society. Were those ever seen as radical?
Well, when it came to the big issues, social liberal issues here, like the same-sex marriage and then the abortion referendum.
This is a monumental day for women in Ireland.
There was a remarkable political consensus. Almost all the leaders of all the main political parties chose the liberal side. So it did not require a hugely kind of bold act of leadership on Varadkar's part to row in behind the liberal side on both of those issues. And that's why he only received a limited amount of kudos from liberal progressives here in Ireland for those successful outcomes in both of those referendums.
And you've compared Varadkar to a Tory, but the Irish political system is quite different to the UK, isn't it? For a long time, two parties have taken turns in being in charge. Varadkar's Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, led by Micheál Martin.
An Ireland for all. That is Fianna Fáil's commitment and philosophy. And that's what we will deliver on during this campaign and beyond.
But they're not so clearly defined as left or right, are they?
Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have dominated Irish politics for a century. They've alternated in power all that time. The divisions between them go back to the Civil War. They took opposite sides in the treaty that led to Irish independence. But over the decades, there's been very little ideological gap between them. They're both centrist parties. Fine Gael a little bit more to the right and Fianna Fáil a little bit more to the left. But really, they appeal to the middle classes and to this kind of centrist view of a rather stable Ireland. And so there's been, Ireland has been a remarkably stable centrist system for a century because of the dominance of both of these parties.
But one of the interesting things is that with days to go, people are talking about parties other than the big two, notably Sinn Féin. And that could be really significant because of a voting system very different to here in the UK. How does it work?
It's a proportional representation system, so not first past the post. And what this means is that even small parties have a very good chance of getting TDs, MPs, elected into Parliament. And this produces a multi-party system, which invariably requires a coalition. No one party will have a majority.
So as leader, how popular was he in Ireland?
He had a great honeymoon upon being elected. He just seemed although he'd been minister for several years, he still seemed such a fresh face. And also, he was able to inherit what was a recovering economy after the fiasco of the financial crash, which bankrupted Ireland.
But now there's no choice but to call it what it's become, a recession. It's more than a word to the hundreds who lost their jobs today, those struggling to buy a home, those businesses scrambling to stay afloat.
His party did the hard job of actually digging Ireland out of this hole, and he was able to steer this recovery and keep it on track. So he had a good record for that. And of course, meantime, he had also Brexit gave him a platform to show what he could do on high-stakes diplomacy.
Certainly from an international perspective, but perhaps in Ireland as well, it feels as if Varadkar's premiership so far has been dominated by Britain leaving the EU, as everyone realised that the Irish question was the most thorny one to address. What did he want for Ireland from the outset, and what role did he play in the negotiations?
Varadkar inherited a negotiating position from his predecessor, Enda Kenny, which was that Ireland wanted to avoid a hard border between the north and south of Ireland, and secondly, to minimise economic disruption in trade between Ireland and the UK.
Our guiding light and our only ambition throughout has been to ensure that the provisions of the Good Friday Agreement continue to operate in full after Brexit.
He played his cards very forcefully and ultimately quite successfully. The backstop, some people actually attribute that term to him, was in a sense his something that he led forcefully and the insistence on that. He said we wanted a bulletproof backstop, meaning to guarantee that there would be no hard border on the island of Ireland. Now, of course, it was that issue that was ended up tormenting the Brexit process for 3 years. And it's remarkable that a country of such small size like Ireland could have been, in a sense, the tail that wagged the Brexit dog. And that was a tribute to the success of Radker and his team in harnessing European Union solidarity behind Ireland's prioritisation of this issue.
I suppose the culmination of what you're talking about was that kind of extraordinary meeting when Varadkar and Boris Johnson got together in Liverpool and then emerged with what looked like the beginning of an agreement.
After more than 2 hours of talks at a country house on the Wirral, the two leaders said a deal was in everybody's interest. Mr. Varadkar said he thought it was still possible that a deal could be done by the end of October, but he declined to say what had changed.
Do you think that the withdrawal agreement was a victory for Ireland?
Brexit ultimately is bad news for Ireland, no matter what form it takes. But yes, I think Ireland and Varadkar played its cards well. It was a game of who's going to blink first. And Britain ultimately blinked first because the Irish had the European Union on their side. So that deal that Varadkar negotiated, the outline of the deal that he did with Boris Johnson in Liverpool, really gave the Irish side pretty much the most important things that they wanted. So from Dublin's point of view, yes, it was definitely a victory.
Brexit wasn't the only thing happening during these years. I mean, what were the other key domestic issues that defined Varadkar's premiership?
The economy, because Ireland had this disastrous boom and bust cycle. And so Fine Gael, the government, was dealing with the legacy of that and trying to fix things. But meantime, underneath the surface, and somewhat and not fully noted really at the time, was the growing problems in terms of public services. The health system has been fraying quite badly, not enough hospital beds. The housing crisis has been bubbling up. This is most manifest in homelessness. You would see now about 10,000 plus people are now homeless in Ireland, which is a record level. Plus affordability, people no longer able to afford to buy or even to rent properties. That's what has been now been creeping up on the government, and that had been kind of bubbling under the surface, although the daily headlines dominated the Brexit and the economy, but as actually these other social issues that were going to become more and more important.
And it's interesting that in that climate that you're describing, 2 weeks ago, Varadkar decided to trigger an early general election. Why?
He had to. He had no choice. There had to be an election this year. His government was a minority government and they had been reliant on support of some independent TDs or members of parliament to get their legislation through. But as the government's unpopularity was growing, these independents were increasingly reluctant to support the government. And so the arithmetic in parliament meant that he had to go to the polls.
Voting's on Saturday. So very, very soon, and things are looking bad for Varadkar in the polls. What's going wrong for him?
There's two huge obstacles for Varadkar to get back into power. One is a voter sense of fatigue with his party. Now, he's been prime minister only for less than 3 years, but his party has been in office for 9 years. And in Irish terms, that's an eternity. And secondly, that sense of like, okay, it's time for a change is amplified by frustration and the sense that many people have been left behind by the economic recovery. And there's a sense that the austerity that Ireland suffered, which was much tougher than anything Britain endured, that's been a bit of a delayed reaction to that. Many people are frustrated and resentful and they want to express change.
Rory, you've been covering the election these past few weeks. What's it been like?
It's been fascinating for me. It's my first Irish general election that I've ever covered. And what's been striking is just how it's so important for politicians here to actually go out and meet people. It sounds like a cliche, but the Irish system really does reward politicians who are out there and do press the flesh. And so following Varadkar, I mean, he's been out.
Do you have any type of broadband, or what do you...
We have to have one of those dongles.
And he is famously quite socially awkward, but he's actually loosened up. Got a lot of people who know him better than I do say he's actually got a lot looser, a bit better at actually just interacting with people as you're, you know, walking down a street.
Do you have an opinion about
him? We love him. He's great. He's doing an amazing work.
What he does have is a certain glamour, certainly in an Irish context.
Lovely appearance.
He always looks so well dressed,
so humble.
So when you walk down the street with him, he's, of course, being the Prime Minister, he has an entourage of TV cameras, photographers, reporters. So you have all this choreography kind of swirling around him. And so when he does, you know, reach a voter and to proffer a hand and say, "Hi, I'm Leo, please vote for Fine Gael," you have a bit of a kind of a circus around him.
Well done.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What do you make of him?
And on one level, what you see is what you get. He has a middle-class Dublin accent. He can be quite suave, sophisticated. This has made it easy for opponents to depict him as urbanite and not in touch with rural Ireland. And this is satirised in Callan's Kicks. It's a radio satire show.
Leo Varadkar. Do I look relatable yet? Has everyone forgotten about the time I told people who couldn't afford a deposit to either borrow it from their moms or emigrate? Lol, that was totes my goats hilaire.
And this has become especially an issue over meat, of all things. Last year, Varadkar said that he wished to start consuming less meat for his health and also for the planet. But this backfired in some rural areas where farmers are struggling because beef prices have collapsed. He has been going around and been taunted by people who now call him a vegan. Say, "Go away, you feckin' vegan, yeah."
The ultimate insult.
Yeah, in certain areas, yes. And on the campaign trail, I've been struck by the amount of times that Varadkar goes into butcher shops and actually buys meat. I was with him on the canvas trail in Dunleary. There he went, and the first thing he did was call into a butcher's kind of kiosk in a park and bought some meat there. But he had an exchange with the butcher, and then about what type of paper they're going to put the meat in. And then he said, "I'd rather have it in paper rather than plastic, because it keeps better in paper."
Paper if you have it, but...
You know, as if trying to like... As if, like, this is a guy who knows his meat, right? You know, it's because you want to keep it in paper, not plastic. And by my count, he's called into at least four butcher shops on the campaign trail. And the point being that, of course, he's being filmed as he does this.
What do you think happens to the meat? I mean, I've got this image of Leo Varadkar sitting there at night, munching on quite a lot of it, taking up the Atkins diet maybe. Or do you think actually his aides are just eating well at the moment?
Well, I have this image of the meat been left in a corner of Fine Gael headquarters, and it's been out of the fridge too long and it's begun to stink a bit. But people are terrified of throwing it out, because what if that leaks? And then, that would make headline news here. So, but I do not actually know what is happening to that meat.
So it sounds like the meat challenge embodies part of the trouble that Varadkar is having on the campaign trail. I mean, did you see any other things that really showed what an uphill battle it could be for him?
I mean, when, for example, I saw him walking past a busker on Grafton Street, and he stopped, listened to the music, took out his wallet and dropped €10, which is pretty generous, and had a quick chat with the busker and the entourage, then moved on. I stayed just to chat to him, the busker. His name is Vincent Fotrell.
How much did he give you?
He gave me a tenner.
He gave you a tenner?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Okay, has he bought your vote?
I don't think so.
Who will you be voting for?
I usually vote Sinn Féin.
So it was like, "Thanks for the €10, Leo, but you haven't bought my vote."
You think tenner would be enough for a vote? And look, that's interesting because, as we've mentioned, Sinn Féin is surging in this election. In 2016, Varadkar's party got over 25%, Fianna Fáil 24%, and Sinn Féin under 14%. But in polls during this race, first Sinn Féin found itself neck and neck with Fianna Fáil, and now it's taken the lead. That is quite something, isn't it?
So this is a potential earthquake in Irish politics.
The establishment knows that Sinn Féin is serious. That's why they try to squeeze us out of this election.
All the more remarkable that Sinn Féin entered this election very defensively. The expectation was that they were actually going to lose seats. And so that's why they actually only fielded less than 45 candidates nationally. And this is for a Dáil with 160 seats.
Sinn Féin is running 42 candidates in 38 constituencies. Candidates who refuse to tolerate an Ireland where inequality is acceptable.
So they're actually braced for losses. And yet what's happened in the last few weeks is that they've been able to ride this wave of frustration with politics as usual. There's a large, it seems, vote out there of people who want to shake things up and who are fed up not only with Fine Gael, but also with the main opposition party, Fianna Fáil, because they're seen as Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Fianna Fáil has been supporting Fine Gael through a confidence and supply agreement for the last several years. So people who are frustrated and feel that their voices and resentments have not been heard are now turning to Sinn Féin.
The fact that they fielded so few candidates presumably means that even if they top the polls, they're unlikely to be the biggest party in terms of TDs. But it does mean that a party that was once the political wing of the IRA, that is committed to a reunified Ireland, could be incredibly influential. Is there any chance that they could be in government in coalition?
Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have both said that, ruled that out, say we will not go into government with Sinn Féin.
One thing that won't happen, you won't see a coalition involving my party and Sinn Féin. That's just not going to happen.
Now, will they continue to say that after the election when we see how the arithmetic stacks up in the Dáil? Well, we'll just have to wait and see for that. But it does mean that even if Sinn Féin does not get into government the next time around, it will only be a matter of time before they do eventually get into government here. And this will help them advance their agenda of United Ireland. And the policy is we want a referendum on Irish unity within 5 years. And that referendum should be in the south of Ireland, the Republic, and in Northern Ireland. This would be a huge seismic issue in Irish politics. If Sinn Féin gets that agenda of United Ireland, you know, become into the mainstream discourse here, then that's going to shake things up a bit and a lot. And we will see consequences in Northern Ireland and in Britain.
It sounds like the type of anti-establishment surge we've seen elsewhere. What do you think is driving support in this way?
There's a certain parallel here with the United States in 2016 when Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump. You know, a lot of Americans felt left behind and they were resentful and they wanted to take a risk by backing a non-conventional candidate. In some ways, you can say the similar dynamic is unfolding here, where people are now sufficiently aggrieved that they're willing to take a risk on Sinn Féin. But the Irish political system, with its system of proportional representation and other things, means that there's still a locus towards the centre. And so the likeliest outcome will be, yes, Sinn Féin will gain a lot more seats, but that Fianna Fáil will still likely be the biggest party and will have the best chance of leading another coalition government.
That kind of takes us back to that disconnect you were talking about between Varadkar's image on the world stage as the broker of the Brexit deal and his woes at home. It's notable that while Fianna Fáil are talking about Brexit, it comes at the end of a list of domestic policies like home ownership, childcare and supporting farmers. If Varadkar does go this weekend, what's next for him?
There's been suspicion for some time that Varadkar has his eye on a big foreign job somewhere in the European Union in Brussels or Strasbourg or possibly even the United Nations. He denies that. He says that should he lose the election, should Fine Gael be tumbled from power, that he will stay on. as party leader of Fine Gael if the party will have him. There will have to be an election within the party to, and he says he would stay on as opposition leader and from the opposition benches lead the opposition to whatever the next government shall be. That would still be quite a humbling role for him. He's had such a meteoric career up to now. It would be quite a shock, really, to see him as, you know, reduced to just being the, you know, a TD for a shrunken, shriveled Fine Gael party.
Rory, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anushka.
That was Rory Carroll, who has been writing some great stuff about the election. Do read his articles at theguardian.com. And turning to politics in the UK, do come along to our Labour leadership hustings on February the 25th that I will be hosting in Manchester. We will also be making an episode for Today in Focus. Go to membership.theguardian.com. Coming up, Westminster journalists stand united.
Hello, I'm Max Rushton, and this is Football Weekly. We cover the football, all the football, from the serious...
It was the most cowardly, disgusting press conference I've ever seen.
...to the analysis...
When you put them into the actual games, Liverpool are getting more points against XG than Leicester.
...to the nonsense.
And I will be having £5 on him to be called a boot winner.
What?
What?
Christian Benteke? Listen to Football Weekly from The Guardian, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, on Monday, Downing Street took the bizarre decision to ask political journalists, known as the lobby, to line up on either side of a rug to mark out which publications were and were not being invited into a room for an official briefing. It led to a revolt by all the journalists present, who walked out en masse. Here's Guardian columnist and former lobby correspondent Gabby Hinsliff.
Whose side are you on? It's a question that gets asked all the time in politics, but rarely so literally as it did on Monday, when a bunch of lobby journalists turning up to what they thought was going to be a briefing by David Frost, the government's chief Brexit negotiator, found themselves divided up into two groups. On one side of the room, the newspapers who were allowed into the briefing, and on the other side of the room, the very publicly uninvited. Now, in this case, The Guardian was on the approved side of the room, and a number of other newspapers, including The Mirror and The Independent, were on the unapproved side of the room. And what happened was that rather than accept that kind of divide and rule strategy, all the journalists walked out, said, "We don't want your briefing, either everyone gets it or nobody gets it." Now, that noise you can hear in the background is obviously the sound of the world's smallest violin playing. I'm well aware that an argument between lobby journalists and politicians is an argument between two of the most unpopular professions in the world, and no doubt many people wish we could both lose. But there's a reason that it matters. It's an important principle of democratic accountability that governments don't get to pick and choose who they're scrutinised by. They don't get to say, "We'll take questions from this journalist that we like, but we won't take questions from this journalist that we don't like." It's important that the readers of all publications are seen to matter equally, and it's your readers you're representing when you ask the Prime Minister a question or try to get some information out of government. And a Mirror reader is just as important as a Mail reader, as a Sun reader, as a Financial Times reader. They all deserve the same level of access and information from government. This isn't just an isolated incident. It's part of a wider trend, which a lot of people attribute to Lee Kane, who's the Prime Minister's Communications Secretary, and Dominic Cummings, his guru of all things Brexit and Downing Street, which is really to try and control the flow of information coming into and out of government. We've had ministers boycotting radio and TV programmes that are deemed to be too hostile to the government's position. So you don't very often hear a minister on the Today programme anymore, for example. The Prime Minister famously avoided doing an interview with Andrew Neil during the general election campaign. We had the Daily Mirror being kicked off the Tory battle bus during the general election. And there's been a wider trend away from doing interviews with broadcasters, more announcements made over Facebook Live, where, of course, you don't get asked questions by someone who has been asking questions of politicians for years. So there's a general feeling that government is ducking scrutiny. The fact that the lobby responded collectively is really important because that's how you respond to attempts to divide and conquer. You stick together. And that's something that's ingrained in lobby reporters' DNA. I mean, I was a lobby reporter for 13 years, and I think it was my second day that someone sat me down and said, look, this is how it works here. It's not like elsewhere in Fleet Street, where basically you would kill each other to get to the story and newspapers are deadly rivals. Sometimes that happens in politics too. But when something really serious or big is going on, the lobby will tend to hunt as a pack. You know, we will swap information with reporters on other papers. If you're in the middle of a press conference and somebody else from another paper doesn't get their question answered, you might pick it up and ask it again. What you're trying to do is work collectively to get at the truth, because you're working on the assumption that it really matters to work out exactly what government is doing. None of this is to deny the fact that the lobby has its flaws and its faults. It's often criticised for being somewhat opaque in its workings or for being too cosy with government. But I think while that sort of herd instinct that lobby reporters do have, it can have its weaknesses. Sometimes you all hair off after one story and you're kind of missing something that's happening on the other side of the pitch. It does have its strengths in circumstances like this, because you're not just rival news organisations beating each other up for the story. You are intent on a common purpose, and that common purpose serves your readers, serves the general public. This isn't the first time something like this has happened within government, and it won't be the last. But I wouldn't underestimate the need to push back. This is a government testing its boundaries, seeing what it can do with the power of an 80-seat majority. And it's wanting to know what happens when it pushes just a little bit too far. And I think it's important to push back.
That was Gabby Hinsliff, who has written a comment piece on this subject. Do have a read. My thanks today to her and to Rory Carroll. And my thanks to you for so many lovely reviews. I particularly like this one. I usually can't stand The Guardian, but found this podcast surprisingly good. Thank you, Max. Keep listening, and we'll convert you to the rest of the reporting too. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.